You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Heavenly Father, thank you so much that we can gather. We so often take for granted the freedom we have to assemble, to gather, to come and go as we please, and to choose to attend, whether it's worship services or evenings like this, where we can learn more about subject matter. Thank you, Lord, that we have that freedom. Thank you for allowing us to be in this space. So just pray for Stephen as he shares, for our ears and hearts, and we do remember friends and loved ones and people abroad who don't have this opportunity right now. And we just lift them up and we hold them in our hearts, Lord. We just ask that you be with us in this time and grow us for the sake of your kingdom. In your name we pray. Amen. Amen. All right, Amen. Stephen, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Thank everybody for being here. Thank Adam for organizing this. Thanks, the Advent. I'm so, glad to have the interest in the subject. I won't go on too long, but I'd been going to Ukraine volunteering for almost 4 years now since the full-scale invasion in 2022, and I've spent maybe about half of my time in Ukraine and half back here. When I'm back here, I'm usually doing something to try to help Ukraine. People ask me why I went to Ukraine. They say, are you Ukrainian? I'm like, no, I'm a Scotch-Irish person. But I just felt the call to go. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do when I got there. I had some ideas, but I'm an attorney, and so I've gotten into all kinds of related issues with war crimes and stuff I could talk more about later. But I spent a lot of time there, and people ask me, oh, how do you go there? It's so dangerous, and it's freezing cold and whatever. But don't give me too much credit. You got to remember, the Ukrainian people who are, especially this winter, literally freezing. People are freezing to death as Putin bombs all the, intentionally destroys all of the power grid, the water, everything, so that people are, literally dying. But also that showing, this incredible spirit, which has kept them going for 4 years. You see they're keeping warm by being out dancing in the streets. And, whatever Putin does to them, they will not give in. They will not give in to it, either in body or spirit. And I think it's important to remember, I'm glad I'm, doing this in the Advent. I work in a, very kind of political and legal and criminal realm, but it's very much a spiritual issue, and it's a moral challenge for our country. I'm not sure how well we're meeting it. Anyway, let me get this. Let me show up. We're going through some things. This is neither here nor there, but just we were going through some little videos, and I thought this was interesting, just that I give you like a little bit of a feel of what it's like over there in the wintertime where I'm out near the front lines. I'm sitting right behind that Coke bottle. And that's just a, every day out in the, this was our last December. This is actually crossing the border from Ukraine into Russia, into Kursk, when the Ukrainians occupied that. And that was a Leopard tank that went by. So anyway, I thought that was interesting to give you all the kind of the feel of things. Let me see. I'm going to give just a little bit of a introduction to orient you a little bit to this film. Is that showing up?
Can put it as a slideshow, and that'll make it full screen if you do slideshow.
Yes, already on there. All right. Okay. Yeah, which that's just the promo for this. Well, just a couple of things to prepare you for the film, which is not a mystery. It's about religious persecution in Ukraine, in the territories occupied by Russia. And some of the things I think is important to, you know, understand about Ukraine, maybe from the beginning, help you understand the film. Like I said, I went there 4 years ago, not really knowing exactly what I was going to do, and kind of got caught up in it. And it's, you know, easy to do. It's an amazing country that nobody knows anything about. I'm trying to start a Ukraine studies program at the University of Alabama because people like really need to understand Ukraine. It's not only now one of the most important issues we face in our foreign policy or whatever that people know nothing about and are also swamped with disinformation. But it's just an incredible country. I never thought about going to Ukraine in my life, and I, you know, probably wouldn't have gone there if Putin hadn't invaded. But it's just an amazing place. And one thing about it that people don't know is Ukraine, well, you know, the first thing I'd say, and it should be, it can't be repeated enough, is that Ukrainians, they are the most freedom-loving people you will find on the earth. They actually put us to shame with our Declaration of Independence, and we think we're a free country and all this stuff. They truly put us to shame, and they have a history of it. People don't, and one reason they appreciate it, they've already lived under the Russians. I mean, so they know what that's like. They lived in the Soviet Union. They do not want to go back to that. And they really would rather die than go back under that. But the history is incredible. Ukraine had really the first modern constitution, like 75 years before the U.S. Constitution in 1710. Ukraine's kind of had a broken history because it's an incredible place. It's the most productive land in the world, grows most of the food in the world. It's been a kind of an invasion crossroads between the Turks and the Vikings and the Mongols and everybody else. And it's had these flickers off and on of being an independent country. And in one of those, they adopted the first modern constitution, which a lot of, which they don't get the credit, but a lot of our ideas came from it, like the separation of powers, limits on the executive, the king can't just do whatever he wants to, but also had the first articles of the Ukrainian Constitution are for freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, which I think is where, you know, our political ideals and our, you know, morality and spiritual values merge. If you know, not get I mean, let the preachers preach, but think about Christianity. Freedom of conscience is a very important tenet. But I don't think people, that's one thing I don't think people know, that Ukraine had a constitution that ours is largely modeled after before we had it, such a thing. Kind of focus on, you know, Ukrainian freedom and sovereignty. Like I said, Ukraine as a recognized country has kind of appeared and disappeared over time. But after World War I, by the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, it was recreated and was very soon snuffed out in what has been a pattern throughout history. When the linen red Russians invaded Ukraine and took it over, and the Ukrainians actually fought as far back as 1919 to not be part of Russia, not be part of the Soviet Union, but they lost that war, suffered all kinds of oppression under Russian-dominated Soviet Union. Most people don't know that in 1932, Stalin artificially created a famine in Ukraine by this kind of Soviet control, taking all their food. People were literally arrested and shot if they were found hoarding or keeping food for themselves to eat in this land that produces more grain and produce than any other place in the world. And Stalin made that a crime for them to keep their own food, and it was all sold for export to build up Soviet industry, and literally millions of Ukrainians starved, and it was part of this pattern that continues to this day of the Russians to try to kind of oppress and wipe out the Ukrainians and dominate. Very relevant to today, in 1991, Ukraine voted for independence, and y'all know the story, I guess it was 89 or so, the Berlin Wall falls and Gorbachev comes in and glasnost. But one of the things that tipped the Soviet Union over the edge and made it completely collapse was the Ukrainians voted for independence. And if you compare that to the news today and you hear our, representing our country, the negotiators go over there and say, well, it's okay if we give some of that territory to Russia, those people, they're really Russians, or they would rather be part of Russia. They voted in 1991 to be free of Russia, to be free of the Soviet Union, and join an independent Ukraine again. And then in 1994, also relevant to today, something was signed called the Budapest Memorandum. When the Soviet Union fell, Ukraine became the third largest possessor of nuclear weapons in the world. And in this effort to prevent nuclear proliferation, somebody came up with a bright idea of, we don't want Ukraine, another country, to have nuclear weapons, so let's give all those nuclear weapons to Russia. Which, one of the least brilliant ideas that ever came along. But Ukraine agreed in exchange for security assurances of their territorial integrity. And, of course, two of the countries that assured Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity were Russia and the United States. Of course, the United States has not really lived up to that assurance, and Russia, of course, has invaded Ukraine, so that they have not been a very good guarantor of that assurance. So when you see anything in the news about peace negotiations and guarantees, assurances of, Ukrainian security, this is important to remember this background, that they were assured that Russia would not invade them before, and that didn't pan out so well. Okay. Yeah. And this, real quickly, this shows in 1991, when they had a referendum, these numbers are the percentages by which all these regions voted to leave the Soviet Union, to be rid of Russia, and be part of a free Ukraine. So these areas, here's Steve Witkoff saying, hey, well, you're really Russians, I really want to be part of Russia. They voted 90%. 90%, 83%, 83%, 90% to leave Russia. And that was in a legitimate referendum. Now they're talking about having another vote today after the Russians have deported all the Ukrainians out of the territory and moved Russians in. They're going to let the Russians vote on. And then kind of the history of modern Ukraine is relevant to all our news today. So in 1991, they elected a president. 94, elected another one. Main thing is to show that, they're, changing the presidents, electing new presidents, mostly having peaceful transfer of power, which unlike Russia, which has now got, had Putin for the last 25 years, and the next 25 years, as far as we know, Putin is in forever. In 2004,
They did have a big upset called the Orange Revolution because a guy named Viktor Yanukovych was elected, and he was a pro-Russian candidate. And part of this 1991 vote and everything in Ukraine's history is they want to be free. Russians are not free. In Russia today, if you saw there's a war in Ukraine, you go to prison for saying that. That's how free they are in Russia. So there was massive fraud, elected this pro-Russian candidate. People were out in the streets because they knew that people had not voted for this pro-Russian candidate. They knew that's not what their country wanted. All these international observers verified that there was massive fraud in the election. So they redid the vote, and Viktor Yushchenko was elected in the revote. But then a strange thing happened in 2010. The same pro-Russia candidate came back, presented himself for election, Viktor Yanukovych, except this time he was a wolf dressed in sheep's clothes. He said he ran, they really fixed him up, and the guy who was his advisor, who kind of remade his image, was somebody you might have heard of named Paul Manafort, and they ran him as a candidate who also wanted to observe the will of the Ukrainian people to move away from Russia and move towards the West and join, specifically to join the European Union. NATO also was an issue, but the European Union was the main thing. But it was all a ruse. So Yanukovych gets elected on these false grounds, and then instead of moving Ukraine towards EU, European Union membership, like he promised and ran on, he said, when it came time to sign all those documents, he's like, no, we're not going to sign that. Actually, we're going to sign an accord with Vladimir Putin and realign Ukraine with Russia. Paul Manafort was paid by Vladimir Putin, by the way. And that's when all hell broke loose. And you might have heard of the Maidan Revolution. People in the streets by the thousands. They had police beating them. They didn't care. They had Russian snipers up in the buildings, like they're shooting people. Hundreds of people were killed. And the people would not stop coming into the streets. They were like, no, we are not going back to Russia. We are not doing it. And so so Yanukovych had to flee. He's in Moscow today. Paul Manafort came back to be somebody's campaign manager in the United States. But so that leads, the Maidan Revolution leads us to 2014, was like a really big year. Yanukovych announces, we're going to realign Ukraine with Russia. The people will not stand for it. They have the Maidan Revolution. Yanukovych flees to Moscow. Manafort flees back to the United States, where he was convicted of all kinds of tax evasion and bank fraud for all these millions of dollars he was paid by Putin. He was hiding in Cyprus and all this stuff. And he was convicted and but pardoned by the president later. But after Yanukovych was driven out, that's when, and this is probably the first time Ukraine ever came into your consciousness, unless you're Ukrainian American, but I know for me, the first time I ever really thought about Ukraine was Putin was invading Crimea. And I remember people thinking, whoa, this is serious. This is going to be World War III. What's going to happen? We actually didn't do much about it, but Putin invaded Crimea and also the eastern part of Ukraine. It's called the Donbass. And so that's the real start of the war. People think the war started in 2022 with the big invasion, but actually there was a low-grade war going on for 10 years before that. The U.S. did not do much about it, except did put sanctions on Russia for invading Crimea and eastern part of Ukraine. Putin's response to the sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Russia was to order cyber attacks against the U.S. elections of 2016. And I don't want to get too much into politics or the church, not politics, but it's kind of a dangerous falsehood. And I heard Pam Bondi say today that Russia did not interfere in the U.S. election. That is a false statement. And in fact, not only did they run massive cyber attacks on the U.S. elections of 2016, they hacked into all 50 state voting systems. Nobody's exactly sure what they did. They ran massive social media fraud campaigns, made up all kinds of fake personas that, you know, spread all kinds of disinformation. And the only reason I mentioned, venture into this a little bit political, is because this is a danger, because this is going on today. The Russians spend $2 billion a year today to spread disinformation, divisive disinformation in the United States. In the last election, a lot of very prominent conservative influencers were being paid by the Russians to spread narratives that had been created by the Russians in the Kremlin, in their intelligence operations. So this is not this is not my opinion. You can read the indictments. The Russians were indicted for it. The Americans were not indicted, but the Russians who paid them were indicted. So this is something that went on in the 2016 election, and it's still going on today. And recently, I can say, because I've worked on the investigations, and there were Russians who were indicted within the last year in very close by in Georgia and Florida for running these kind of disinformation campaigns to upset our election system. So it's very dangerous just to try to say that never happened, because it did happen and it's still happening. So Putin orders these cyber attacks. This kind of low-grade war goes on. They come up with something called the Minsk Accords. It's supposed to have a ceasefire in place until they can negotiate some things. The Russians never observe the ceasefires. They're attacking Ukraine all the time. And during this time, let me see. Let me go back to, let me see, I've got another map I want to go to explain this. So here's Ukraine. This red, this is what's occupied by the Russians today after the full-scale invasion. And they occupy most of this area called Luhansk, and then this other area called Donetsk. But during this period of this low-level war that went on for 10 years before the full-scale invasions, the Ukrainians built what they call the fortress belt, very strong fortifications all through this area of Donetsk, so the Russians, 2014, 12 years later, are still trying to penetrate these defenses, which they can't, and they, kind of creeping along, even though they're taking massive casualties. Like they'll take 1,000 casualties to, advance, 500 meters. But it's important to remember for today that there are these very strong fortifications that the Ukrainians built up in that area that have kept the Russians pinned in for the last, 12 or 15 years. Okay, yeah, and so, one more thing I want to cover before we get to the film is, why did the Ukrainians not want to be part of Russia? Why did they leave the USSR? Some things we'll understand very well. Affordability, Soviet Union had a crap economy. Russia still has a crap economy. Ukraine is this incredible, vibrant, developing nation. I mean, you could go there, you'd be shocked at with high tech and things where they're ahead of us in their daily lives. And that was a shock to me. I saw on TV, I thought, oh, Ukrainians, they're all little old women who live in, you know, huts in a village and milking their cows. It's an incredible dynamic economy. One reason the Russians got slaughtered when they tried to take Kyiv, when they got close to Kyiv, they were told they're going to go liberate all these barbarians in Ukraine, and they got there, and it was like, they showed up, and it was like, you know, outside of Kyiv, and it was like, you know, the Galleria or the summit, and they're like, what in the world? They stopped to loot the Apple stores and stuff and got fried in the meantime. Another big reason that the Ukrainians wanted to have nothing to do with Russia and the Soviet Union is the corruption that was inherent in the Soviet Union. And you hear people, it's important, people talk about, people who want to say, we shouldn't help Ukraine. They say, oh, Ukraine is corrupt. And there's a lot of corruption in Ukraine, like there's a lot of corruption in the United States. But it's important to understand the Ukrainians have, you know, everything they've done in the Maidan Revolution, everything else, you know, the whole country saying, we want to be rid of this corruption. They are trying much harder to get rid of corruption than we are. I can promise you that. The obvious kind of political oppression, Soviet Russian, Chernobyl is in Ukraine. And that was, you know, a huge nuclear disaster, which was a result of lies that they tried to cover up with lies. And the Ukrainians are like, no more lies, thank you. We don't want any more Russian lies. Also, the Russian Soviets, aggressive all the time, invading other... Ukraine has no interest in invading any other country. And they want to have political freedoms. And above all, to get right into the film, one of the most important things is religious freedom. Starting back with our constitution, Ukraine is incredibly pluralistic religious country now. You can find every kind of church. Anybody can go to any church. They go whatever they want to. Russia has a state religion, which is actually it's an arm of the state and more like part of the KGB than it is an actual church. So I might have gone on too long, but now that's your introduction to the movie here.
I am pastor 32 years and I miss my church. When Russia occupied territory, Ukrainian army, they told me, pastor, you must run away from city because Russia, they have a target. They want to kill me and my church.
All across Russian-occupied Ukraine, soldiers are shutting down places of worship.
Росіяни були практично всі це. Я знаю пасторів, у яких дітей заарештовували, да, таким чином чинили на них.
Russian forces are closing churches and persecuting Christians.
In Russia, church is a political instrument. In Ukraine, it's not the same. Today, many churches are destroyed. And they are destroyed not by accident.
Russians said because I am an evangelical Christian, he have to cast out demons. They started torturing me.
This battle in Ukraine, it's about religion. Freedoms, and we must stop them.
Turn off the recorder to sound the battery or whatever, just to pause it here so it's not recording.
My name is Coley Barrett. I'm a Christian living in Telluride, Colorado with my wife.
Okay, you go. Proceed.
Okay.
I think we all owe Stephen keep the film a round of applause.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, Sid. Like I said, owe the applause to the people of Ukraine. I hope I'm interested to hear how you felt about it. Obviously, it's different for me. I see all that, and those are people I know and have experienced all that. So I'm interested to see how it impacts you and how much what you saw resonated with the introduction to Ukraine that I gave you, and to kind of preface everything. One thing I'll say is what you saw is just so barely scratching the surface of what's going on every day all over Ukraine. And you probably see how once I got started into this, I was never ready to stop, because they're just endless, bottomless need and endless suffering, and especially in the occupied territories. There's a lot of talk now about, let's just draw a line somewhere and be done with it. But you have to think the people on the wrong side of that line. You see there's suffering and death and destruction all over Ukraine, but the persecution going on in the Russian occupied territories, the abduction of children, thousands and thousands of children kidnapped, the religious persecution, and the incredible, and torture and murder, which is affects the religious community, but it's not limited to the religious community. It affects everybody. It's hard to, I remember being, shocked at the situation. So there's so much oppression in the Russian occupied territories that those Ukrainians who live there, they all have friends and family back in Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine. They don't dare even get on the phone with their friends and family. They'll be taken up by the FSB and taken into, literally arrested and taken away. But the other, observation what I would make is that the Russians still cannot keep down the spirit of the Ukrainian people. Well, that's so true what is said in the film. If they bomb, a building, the next day Ukrainians will have it all cleaned up. Now, this proposal experience I teach at the law school in Kyiv, and the Russians fired a missile. You might have seen it was actually in the news, because it hit a children's playground behind my office. And the next day you would have never known. All the windows were blown out in our offices, but you would never know anything happened, and the children were back there playing again. And also, it's true what they show about the churches. I've been in many churches in Ukraine, and they are overflowing with joy, like you saw. It's unbelievable. The Russians cannot win, no matter what they do. We need to help the right side. The other thing I'd say about the people is very true what they said in the film. The people who are on the wrong side of the line, just think, we're just going to draw a line and, have new borders for countries. Those people, they are waiting every day to be liberated. And
see, how many year numbers of, not most trumpet numbers, of the men being killed, stores.
Fight, but I had a purpose civilian count of how many.
I don't know the civilian count, but you can kind of go through it. Every day now. One thing I will say is that in the last year, it has gotten exponentially worse in every way. The attacks on the front are worse. The Russians are pouring more and more thousands of troops in. They'll take any number of casualties to advance 100 meters, bringing in North Korean troops, which has to be alarming to everybody. But it's changed so that it used to be, never mind the front line, talk about just being in Kyiv or Lviv. My client, Yaroslav, whose family was killed 600 miles from the Russian border. It used to be a big night. in Kyiv if the Russians fired 20 missiles. And now it's 800 missiles in one night. They start, missiles and drones, it starts at midnight, wave and wave comes, a wave comes at midnight, a wave comes at 1 o'clock in the morning, a wave comes at 2 o'clock in the morning, a wave comes at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it goes on until dawn. So it used to be that, you know, most of them were shot down, but their strategy is to send so many that they can't all be shot down. They almost all hit civilian targets. So, I mean, you can look in the newspaper every day and see, you know, 5 more Ukrainians were killed last night, you know, 3 children. They also deliberately strike schools, maternity wards, hospitals. I was there the day that school opened, you know, first day of school. Y'all remember first day of school, going to Crestline and Cherokee Bend? The Russians usually attack at night. The first day of school, they sent their missile attacks in the morning when all the people were taking their kids to school. That's what the Ukrainian children were treated to. So, you know, like I said, you know, they want to be liberated. And, you know, I have to go back and, you know, face Yaroslav in person. And it's a, you know, it's a shame on me if I haven't, you know, done enough. You know, I just feel like every American needs to face the evil that Putin is doing and ask, you know, what you're going to do about it, what we are going to do about it, which right now is rather pathetic, I have to say. But that's all I have to say if people want to ask any questions.
Can you share more about the work you're doing?
Yeah. Well, let me see if I can. It's kind of a long list of things. I've never been such a multitasker, but I, you know, I work with the Ukrainian government, the Ukrainian military. I teach in the law school. I've helped make documentary films. I'm trying to get back to my. And I work, you know, the focus on war crimes. Can y'all see that? So, anyway, this is, you know, one of my, you know, I'm kind of the head person leading this war crimes initiative, working with, like I said, the Ukrainian government, military, every facet of their society. I, you know, work with that group that was in the film Save Ukraine, that's going to, you know, rescue children. Very difficult and dangerous work, you know, to find a child in Russia and get them back to Ukraine. Can't really go into it, but it's, I guess it's very difficult and very, very dangerous. So I first thing I did when I went to Ukraine, I was mainly, back in 2022, I was mostly in the areas of Irpin and Bucha, which you probably heard of Bucha, which is the first place that just horrific Russian war crimes were discovered when they were forced to abandon their attempt to take Kyiv. And, I mean, I just can't even tell you what was there. And Irpin was just as bad. So I was helping document those war crimes. One of my major initiatives is to bring civil cases. So if you have a war crime, that's a criminal prosecution. It means, you know, the penalty is like you go to prison or whatever, which means you have to have the person. Like, I tell you, my fondest goal would be to try Putin in The Hague and send him to prison or to be hanged for that matter. But may not happen to have Nuremberg. You have to win the war and catch the people. So I have developing
all these test civil cases that parallel the potential criminal prosecutions. You know, same thing in the United States. If, somebody has a DUI and they, you know, kill somebody, you know, they can go to prison for that. That's the criminal penalty. But also the family can sue them in a civil case and take their money. So I am developing the civil parallels to the criminal prosecutions, and so we can't send Putin to jail. We can take his money, we can take his yacht, billions of dollars in frozen Russian assets. So the idea is to, and this is obviously novel legal ground, so I don't ever get to do the easy cases as a lawyer. I got the hard thing. This is like creating new law and new precedent, just as Nuremberg was creating new law and precedent when they did it. But so I'm developing a test case in each of these areas to try to bring, you know, one case to a judgment and then collect, hopefully, against the frozen Russian assets that are there are billions in the United States, hundreds of billions in Belgium. So I represent a Ukrainian, happen to know a Ukrainian Belgian, not that many of those, but who owned a lot of properties in Kherson that were destroyed and looted and everything. So we have a test case against the Russians for that. It's just a simple, you know, property damage case, really very simple case, but that we can collect in Belgium against but let me run through this real quick and I'll answer your question. But so there's, you know, going to be one test case for religious prosecution, one for targeting civilians, that's Yaroslav that you saw in the film, one for torture of POWs. I represent two guys from Alabama who went over there and volunteered for the Ukrainian International Brigade, were captured, tortured for months. You don't want to hear about destruction of cultural heritage, the kidnapping of Ukrainian children, crimes of aggression, which is a new tribunal that we're trying to establish in Strasbourg, because just the this was not covered by Nuremberg or anything that exists, even in the International Criminal Court of the Hague, just to make it a crime to invade the country next door for no reason. So I'm trying to work on that. And then, of course, all of these things add up to genocide, which, you know, the Russians are basically trying to destroy the whole Ukrainian population and culture and everything. So, and the idea is if we can, you know, take any of these cases to their, you know, conclusion to get a judgment and collect, there are 1,000 similar cases that can come behind it. So I'm having to try to put together, I can't do it by myself. So putting together, working with the Ukrainian government and with some of these organizations that you saw in the film, and also trying to drag in other law firms and, you know, donors and benefactors and all that kind of thing to put together this whole, you know, operation, which is kind of annoying that this keeps timing out. But you had a question before.
I think I was going to ask to say, well, you mentioned Strasbourg, but what legal jurisdictions and in what form does it take you on this basis?
Well, yeah, so far there had been some war crimes prosecutions in Ukraine where the Russian was captured and sentenced for killing civilians. So that is about it so far. Of course, what's going on in the meantime is the most massive, you think the Epstein files are huge with millions of documents, probably the most massive evidence collection operation in the history of the world. There's a war going on. Everybody's got their cell phone out and everything else and all this OSINT and everything else. There's that's one of the problems is how to collect and store and coordinate all the evidence and all, you know, between all the different groups from the UN, the Ukrainians, everybody's collecting evidence, me. But
when I talk about these, you know, strikes that happen every night in Kyiv, and say 30 drones and missiles get through and hit buildings, you not only are there people, like you talked about, they're cleaning everything up, but before that happens, there's a team from the Ukraine, the Kyiv police or the SBU or all of the different agencies, they're collecting, you know, evidence, and they're there. It's a wonder how the Ukrainian people are not worn out. One building gets blown up, evidence correction team working all night and all morning, the firemen, you know, putting out the Russians. And I can't overstate how horrible the Russians are. One of their favorite things is to do like a double tap. So they hit a building and wait for all the first responders to show up and then hit it again to kill the firemen and the medics and everything. It's just beyond anything. But so did that answer some of your question?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, wondering where you take these cases.
Yeah, well, we're creating the law. Like in the case of aggression, that's something we're pushing. And that's something that the U.S. used to support until this year when the U.S. withdrew support for establishing this court in Strasbourg, which would have a new special jurisdiction over the crime of aggression. It'd be a new thing that never existed before. But U.S. supported it.
Treaty?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the U.N. founding treaty? Did it just not create a criminal penalty?
I don't know. You're getting maybe a little too much in the weeds even for me. I don't know. But
so you're having to sort of create a lot of new legal theory in a way.
Well, yeah, that's the basic idea. And there are all kinds of, you know, I don't want to do too much law school here with all the treaties and different things involved. It's very complicated. But
so you have a team of Ukrainian lawyers with you?
Well, I'm not. Well, I'm trying to, you know, create a team, you know, the Ukrainians. So I volunteer. I go there and volunteer. The Ukrainians, you know, you can't ask them to volunteer. So, you know, we're paying them. And yeah, so that's, well, I write them a check, but hopefully, you know, I can, you know, there's, you know, obviously, you know, needs to be a fundraising operation behind it because, you know, unlike Sid, there's an end in my pocket. So, like,
you know, that's not true.
But, somebody else had a question.
Did anyone file any civil case? I hear the criminal part, then you've got to get the criminal. But on the civil side, which you were talking about, where would you file that case?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, again, I don't like to go too much law school, but every case we look at, you know, what are the facts, what's the jurisdiction, what are the connections? So, like, for example, you know, it's not good that they were captured and tortured, but it's good for me that I have two American clients. So we're going to file that case in Ukraine and get a judgment and then come and enforce it in the U.S. And there's some kind of arcane legal reasons that it's better for us to file the case in Ukraine. I don't want to get too much into. But anyway, and so the same thing with, you know, having the, you know, Lodi from Kherson who has a connection to Belgium so that we can go collect in Belgium, which is where the most of the frozen Russian assets are. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of very complicated legal issues that go into, but obviously the more connections you have to a forum, you know, the more, you know, legal standing you have to try to, you know, operate in that forum and, or even, you know, to collect in that forum. So
you're taking much of this information up to the United Nations?
Well, I don't, but I'm, you know, someone in Ukraine is doing that. Is you know, I don't interact much with the UN. I mean, I know some people, they're like, they're people from, you know, everywhere and every organization, the EU, UN, and working in Ukraine, but I don't work directly with the UN.
Steve, in those wars in the past, there's always been so much death and destruction in its wake of people, civilians, military, for property. You know, Europe was bombed to death at one point.
World War II. I mean, there's, I don't know, and it may be way too much to even touch upon, but as far as international law in terms of engagement of warfare, where do we draw the line? I mean, I know it's one thing just to, you know, deliberately go hit a school or a hospital, that could be considered war crimes, but when you're just engaging in warfare and in its path, civilians and property.
Well, obviously the point of a war is to kill and people and destroy things, but, you know, but the lines have been progressively drawn. We had the UN Charter, the Geneva Convention, you know, where, you know, certain things are, you know, recognized, of, you know, even in war, which is barbaric by itself. But like this, some things are too barbaric even for war and, you know, targeting civilians. Like I said, you know, we're trying to expand that line to just, you know, the crime of aggression. Like you know, send your tanks over a border like Hitler or Stalin did, you know, that's a crime. It's, you know, which we're trying to have recognized. Because, and honestly, you know, everybody thought, at least in, certainly in Europe, that kind of Hitler roar was over, had long been over until Putin brought it back.
Anything else?
Do you see any possibility? I know they have, efforts have been made to negotiate and negotiate and negotiate and negotiate. Do you see a huge possibility of negotiation being reached anytime soon?
Well, the short answer to that is no. I mean, if I can get this thing to, I think I have a little slide. Yeah. So, what I'll say now, I mean, the only way, in my opinion, to try to bring the Russian invasion, and I think it's very important to distinguish, like, this is not just a war, like these two countries decided to go to war with each other. This is a Russian invasion of another country that never wanted to be in a war, and the war could end today if Putin would decide to go home. I mean, the Ukrainians are not going to invade Russia, you know, pursue him into Russia or anything, you know. So Putin could go home any day. The Ukrainians, they can't go home. They're being bombed in their homes. You talk about civilians being killed. Yeah, Ukrainian civilians are being killed. Russian civilians are not being killed. It's all one-sided. So I think it's very important not to live in an illusion, but it's like two sides. And that's what we hear, you know, a lot. It's like, oh, they're just killing each other. That's not what's happening. One side is invading the other side. The terms that are on the table now are just, I just tell you, it's a complete non-starter. The Ukrainians will never accept it. They would, and Putin won't accept, you know, anything that's slightly reasonable. So, you know, what we have now, and, you know, this is the United States position right now. This is the United States official position. No Russian territorial concession. So, you know, you would have thought, okay, well, you're going to have a peace negotiation. The Russians have illegally invaded and seized territory of another country. Like, maybe the solution is, well, you know, Ukraine can't force them out of all of it, but part of the solution is maybe, you know, Russia gives up some territory and goes back. But no, that's not part of the deal. Immunity for all Russian war crimes that we've all been through. Nobody's prosecuted Putin. Putin's already indicted as a war criminal for the abduction of children, but all that would be washed away. Not only does Russia not have to make any territorial concessions, but part of the deal, this is the position that U.S. negotiators are pressuring Ukraine to accept, that Ukraine should give up territory that the Russians have not been able to take since 2014. So it's like 12 or 13 years they've been fighting to try to take the whole Donbas. And that's why I mentioned in the beginning about how the Ukrainians had built this fortress belt in the Donbas that the Russians have not been able to penetrate. The official U.S. negotiating position is that the Ukrainians should give up that fortress belt, let the Russians just skip over it for free, take the entire Donbas. And of course, keep bear in mind, the Russians have never kept any agreement they ever made ever in their history. And what the United States is proposing is that the Russians get to jump over the Ukrainian defenses, in which, you know, a year later when they decide to break the agreement and attack, there's no line of defense between them left between them and Kyiv. This is the official U.S. position. Ukraine, who is not the aggressor, Ukraine, the country who's attacked, has to limit the size of its armed forces. Russia, the attacker, does not have to limit the size of their armed forces.
But that's not all of that's nonsense.
Yes, that's my point. It is nonsense, but that's the official U.S. position.
But yeah, but it's also, we're putting over 100,000 European troops there. They get to seize the Russian assets that are being held.
No, that's not right. That's not right.
That's not what that says, but...
That's not our position. That's not our position. That is not our position. I don't know where you got that, but that's...
New York Times.
The U.S. Negotiating position is that the Russian assets go into a joint fund for development, joint U.S.-Russian development in Russia. Our position is not for the frozen assets to go to rebuild Ukraine.
Now, excuse me for being politically incorrect and red-staked, but if anything, even half, one-tenth of that happens, it's because there's authoritarian leave here in Washington.
Well, we're taking a totally pro-Putin.
Somebody's going to get some money.
Well...
like he does in all over the world a year ago.
Well, yeah. Well, that's also true. So, you know, so Witkoff and all these people would be part of these deals that they're talking about. But
well, how do you fight something like that?
Well, I don't know. Call Katie Britt. I don't know. I mean, this is so absurd. I mean, first, this is not working. This is not going to ever happen. They can go have all the meetings between Steve Witkoff, and he can prance across the stage and hug Putin and all he wants to. But this is never, you know, Ukraine is never going to go for this. Putin will not agree to certain things. You talk about the putting, you know, European security forces in Ukraine to guarantee that the Russians won't attack again. Putin will not agree to that.
But he didn't agree that we seized his ship in the Indian Ocean yesterday either, and we still did.
Well,
I mean, the French seized one too, but they're the only Europeans who've done it.
I don't know. Well, that's, you know, that's great. We seize a ship, but meanwhile, we're trying to give away the Donbas, and Putin will, you know, won't agree to European troops in Ukraine.
The first map he showed, or one of the first maps, show the different states or territories and how they know it in a nice. And the only one that was about 50-50 was...
Crimea. It was 54%. So even in Crimea, a majority voted to leave Russia. Let me see. Here's them.
I mean, has anybody just thought... Because they took Crimea 12 years ago.
Yeah, well... So it's important to understand, when they took Crimea, that was when Ukraine basically had no government. This is the same time, you know, Yanukovych has had to flee. They have an interim government. They're trying to set up a new government. By the way, the corruption that they found when Yanukovych left, he had, like, lived in this mansion with his own private zoo. All kinds of, it was just insane. And that's where they also found all the records of all the millions of dollars that Paul Manafort had been paid by the Russians. But this is back to the map. So here's Kyiv, here's Crimea, this is Donetsk and Luhansk right here. So this is the area you probably... You know, heard all these places in the news recently, Pokrovsk, And I've, you know, been to all these places, Kramatorsk, Slovyansk, Kupiansk, Usium, Liman. This is where that fortress belt is. And so, like, right here you see, this is a part of, in 12 years, Russia's been able to take part of Donetsk, but there, here's this part of Donetsk that they haven't been able to take. The official U.S. negotiating position that they're pressuring Ukraine to accept is to give this area to Russia that they have not been able to take in 12 years of fighting. We'll just give that to them. And of course, that allows them to skip over all these defenses. Yes.
Another thought is that all the other things going on in the world can affect their legal scanning, precedent, and support for any legal cases you bring against another nation. And so I try to bring these cases against Russia. There's another conflict that's gone on recently with supposed atrocities and other things over in the Middle East. And do you feel like the soft hand being given in that country would affect your ability to bring a precedent case against Russia?
Yeah, that's a hard question. You know, and there are a lot of issues we could talk about, you know, all night. I try not to get into Israel. More bandwidth than I can, you know, deal with. But I understand your point. There's a lot that's gone on there and been forgiven. So anyway, I'm just trying to concentrate on a precedent for Ukraine.
What do you think Ukraine would accept? Or what are they negotiating for?
Well, the main thing they're negotiating for, which Putin is against, is for Ukraine to exist as a viable country. You know, what Putin is proposing is something that would leave Ukraine in a state of virtual collapse and certainly vulnerable to the next Russian invasion when Putin does not keep the treaty and nobody does anything to stop him. So yeah, one of the things I left off, I don't remember if it was on the list, but that you know, Putin is demanding that Ukraine hold all new elections. They haven't had an election because they're in the middle of a war, and you know, how are these Ukrainians in Russian territory supposed to vote? It's actually, it was in Ukrainian law before the invasion that, you know, if martial law is declared because of a war, that they won't hold elections. But so Putin says, you know, Zelensky is illegitimate because they haven't had an election, or haven't had an election because they've been invaded by Russia. And meanwhile, you know, Putin, of course, murders his political opponent. So, you know, the idea that the United States is pressuring Ukraine, like, Ukraine, you have to have an election, but Putin does not have to have a real election, and he can murder Navalny, murder Nemtsov, and murder everybody.
What is your understanding of the people in Ukraine that you picked up on insofar as Putin goes? What if he was gone? What if he died or that first out of the window?
Well, that's hard to say. You know, people are worried that, you know, maybe somebody worse would come in. There's also an issue of, you know, it's not just one person. So this war is supported in Russia because they have total state-controlled media that, you know, gives, well, so I know, and y'all could know better than I, but, you know, I have friends who, you know, because these are both part of the Soviet Union, there's a lot of Russia-Ukrainian mixture, Ukrainians living in Russia and Russians living in Ukraine, and I know somebody who lives, where was it, right here in Vinnytsia, and she has a sister that lives in Moscow. And they argue on the phone, it's like, just like Americans on a table. You know, her sister in Moscow is saying, you know, I support the war. We've got to liberate Ukraine from all these Nazis. And her sister, Denise, is going like, are you talking about me? Your sister, am I the Ukrainian Nazi you're talking about? You know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense, but... Yeah, that's right. But anyway, it's a strange thing that happens to people's minds when they're bombarded with lies all day, every day. And that's what's happening in Russia.
Don't you? Will any of your work involve, like they mentioned in the movie, the documentary, the arrests of some Ukrainian Orthodox bishops for cooperating with the Russian church?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, already happening, you know, just same as any other criminal investigation when there's, you know, when there's evidence to support it. You know, people get caught, like, revealing the time and location of a weapons shipment so that the Russians can hit it. And, you know, those people, you know, it's a regular police investigation and they're arrested. Yeah, thanks for coming. I say, oh yeah, see, I'm going over my time.
Free to hang around and talk to Stephen a little bit more. Thank you for coming to all me here and see me. Yeah, you fall.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.